Disc 3. In warding off outside temptations, President Cooper also looked askance at the political protests mounted nearby. King's College had evolved into the fortress of British orthodoxy that William Livingston and Presbyterian critics had feared, with the Anglican reverence for hierarchy and obedience breeding subservience to royal authority. During the Revolution, the British Army was to take malicious pleasure in converting Presbyterian and Baptist churches into stables or barracks. To President Cooper's consternation, King's College stood one block west of the Common, now City Hall Park, a popular spot for radicals to congregate in. During Hamilton's stay at the college, an 80-foot pole towered over this grassy expanse, around the top of which spun a gilded weather vane with the single word Liberty on it. Hamilton's debut as a rabble-rousing orator was to take place in this very park. With fewer than 25,000 inhabitants, New York was already second in size among American colonial cities, behind Philadelphia, but edging ahead of Boston. Founded as a commercial venture by the Dutch West India Company in 1623, the city already had a history as a raucous commercial hub, a boisterous port that blended many cultures and religions. 14 languages were spoken there by the time Hamilton arrived. Each year, its congested wharves absorbed thousands of new immigrants, mostly British, Scotch, and Irish, and Hamilton must have appreciated the city's acceptance of strangers carving out new lives. His friend Gouverneur Morris later observed that to be born in America seems to be a matter of indifference at New York. The settled portion of the city stretched from the Battery up to the Common. Shaded by poplars and elms, Broadway was the main thoroughfare, flanked by mazes of narrow, winding streets. There were sights galore to enthrall the young West Indian. Fetching ladies promenaded along Broadway, handsome coaches cruised the streets, and graceful church spires etched an incipient skyline. Rich merchants had colonized Wall Street and Hanover Square, and their weekend pleasure gardens extended north along the Hudson Shore. On his way to the Continental Congress in Philadelphia in 1774, John Adams admired the city's painted brick buildings and praised its streets as vastly more regular and elegant than those in Boston, and the houses are more grand as well as neat. At the same time, the inhabitants already conformed to the eventual stereotype of fast-talking, sharp-elbowed, money-mad strivers. "They talk very loud, very fast, and all together," Adams protested. "If they ask you a question, before you can utter three words of your answer, they will break out upon you again and talk away." The opulence made the poverty only more conspicuous. During the glacial winter of 1772 to 1773, the East River froze and the municipal hospital was overrun with indigent patients. Crime was so pervasive that ground had recently been broken for Bridewell Prison. Hamilton must have entered King's in late 1773 or early 1774 because his stay overlapped with that of Edward Stevens, his St. Croix friend, and Robert Troup, both of whom graduated by the summer of 1774. President Cooper listed Hamilton among 17 students who matriculated in 1774. Since the average King's student entered at 15, one again suspects that the 19-year-old Hamilton took the liberty of subtracting 2 years from his age. To gratify the youth's insistence upon rapid advancement, Cooper granted Hamilton status as a special student who took private tutorials and audited lectures but did not belong, at least initially, to any class. In September 1774, Hamilton contracted with Professor Robert Harper to study math. Trained in Glasgow, Harper probably introduced his new pupil to the writings of David Hume and other worthies of the Scottish Enlightenment. It took 9 years for Hamilton to discharge his debt to Harper, suggesting that even armed with the St. Croix subsidy, Hamilton had to make do on a stringent budget and never quite forgot that he was a charity student. There are no extant drawings of Hamilton at this age. From later descriptions, however, we know that he stood about 5'7" and had a fair complexion, auburn hair, rosy cheeks, and a wide, well-carved mouth. His nose, with its flaring nostrils and irregular line, was especially strong and striking, his jaw chiseled and combative. Slim and elegant, with thin shoulders and shapely legs, he walked with a buoyant lightness, and his observant, flashing eyes darted about with amusement. His later Federalist friend and ally, Fisher Ames, left some graphic impressions of Hamilton's appearance. Of his eyes, he said, these were of a deep azure, eminently beautiful, without the slightest trace of hardness or severity, and beamed with higher expressions of intelligence and discernment than any others that I ever saw. Ames often bumped into Hamilton on his daily walks and said he displayed in his manners and movements a degree of refinement and grace which I never witnessed in any other man, and I am quite confident that those who knew him intimately will cheerfully subscribe to my opinion that he was one of the most elegant of mortals. It is impossible to conceive a loftier portion of easy, graceful, and polished movements than were exhibited in him. Though Hamilton acquired greater urbanity later on, even as a young man, fresh from the islands, he had a dignified air of self-possession remarkable in a former clerk. At first, Hamilton aspired to be a doctor and attended anatomy lectures given by Dr. Samuel Clossie, a pioneering surgeon from Dublin. Upon arriving in New York in 1767, Clossie had acquired quick notoriety as a practitioner of the black art of snatching cadavers from local cemeteries for dissection. The practice was not outlawed until 1789, after it sparked a massive riot. Clossie's lectures stayed firmly embedded in Hamilton's retentive memory. Years later, Hamilton's physician, Dr. David Hosick, recalled, I have often heard him speak of the interest and ardor he felt when prosecuting the study of anatomy under Clossie. He further remarked of Hamilton that few men knew more of the structure of the human frame and its functions. Though not an outstanding school, King's offered a solid classical curriculum of Greek and Latin literature, rhetoric, geography, history, philosophy, math, and science. Hamilton at once proved himself a student of incomparable energy, racing through his studies with characteristic speed. I cannot make everybody else as rapid as myself, he was to one day write laughingly to his wife. This you know by experience. From his college essays, we can tell that he ransacked the library, poring over the works of Locke, Montesquieu, Hobbes, and Hume, as well as those of such reigning legal sages as Sir William Blackstone, Hugo Grotius, and Samuel von Pufendorf. He was especially taken with the jurist Emmerich de Vatel, whom he lauded as the most accurate and approved of the writers on the laws of nations. Supplemented by voracious reading, Hamilton was able to compensate for his childhood deficiencies. After King's, he could rattle off the classical allusions and exhibit the erudition that formed parts of the intellectual equipment of all the founding fathers. Also, he would be able to draw freely on a stock of lore about Greek and Roman antiquity, providing essential material for the unending debates about the fate of republican government in America. Hamilton was often spotted shortly after dawn, chattering to himself, as if unable to contain the contents of his bursting brain. He paced the Hudson River bank and rehearsed his lessons, or walked along tree-shaded Bateau Street, later Day Street. Based on a schedule that Hamilton later drew up for his son, we can surmise that he followed a tight daily regimen, rising by 6 and budgeting most of his available time for work, but also allocating time for pleasure. His life was a case study in the profitable use of time. Hamilton showed little interest in student pranks and pratfalls, and his name does not appear in the college's black book, which recorded infractions against Miles Cooper's rules. Offending students were forced to memorize lines from Horace or translate essays from The Spectator into Latin. When Hamilton was at King's, his friends were struck by his religious nature, though some of this may have stemmed from the school's requirements. There was obligatory chapel before breakfast, and bells chimed after dinner for evening prayers. On Sunday, students had to attend church twice. His chum at King's, Robert Troop, was convinced that Hamilton's religious practice was driven by more than duty. He was attentive to public worship and in the habit of praying on his knees night and morning. I have often been powerfully affected by the fervor and eloquence of his prayers. He had read many of the polemical writers on religious subjects, and he was a zealous believer in the fundamental doctrines of Christianity. The vivacious Hamilton never had trouble making friends. Troop, the son of a sea captain, was soon his warmest companion. At King's, Troop wrote, they occupied the same room and slept in the same bed, and continued to live together for a time after Troop graduated. Born in Elizabethtown in 1757, Troup had also become an orphan, his father having died in 1768, the year Hamilton's mother died, and his mother the following year. As with Hamilton, some friends took responsibility for Troup's welfare. Adolescent hardship instilled in Troup a lasting sense of financial insecurity, and he was amazed that Hamilton worried so little about money. "I have often said that your friends would be obliged to bury you at their own expense," Troup wrote to Hamilton in later years, a statement that was to prove queasily prophetic. Was it pure happenstance that Troup and Hamilton roomed together, or did Miles Cooper guess that they would forge a secret bond among the more affluent boys? Where early sorrow had toughened Hamilton, hardening his self-reliance, it made Troup insecure and prone to hero worship. Bright and jovial, favored with an easy laugh, he idolized his gifted friends and came to enjoy the odd distinction of being a confidant of both Hamilton and Burr. In one letter, Burr referred to Troup fondly as that great fat fellow, and said another time, "He is a better antidote for the spleen than a ton of drugs." Both Hamilton and Burr were prey to depression and appear to have been buoyed by Troup's exuberant humor. In Hamilton's first months at King's, he and Troup formed a club that gathered weekly to hone debating, writing, and speaking skills. The other members, Nicholas Fish, Edward Stevens, and Samuel and Henry Nicol, rounded out Hamilton's first circle of intimates. Small literary societies were then a staple of college life, their members composing papers and reading them aloud for comment. Hamilton was the undisputed star. "In all the performances of the club," Troup said, "Hamilton made extraordinary displays of richness, of genius, and energy of mind." As tension with England worsened, many discussions hinged on the question of royal-colonial relations. At first, Hamilton didn't differ much from the loyalist views espoused by Miles Cooper and was originally a monarchist, Troup asserted. He was versed in the history of England and well acquainted with the principles of the English Constitution, which he admired. As Hamilton's views evolved, however, and he began to publish the outspoken anti-British pieces that made his reputation, he used the debating club at King's to preview his essays. The colonial struggle against the crown took a dramatic turn on the moonlit night of December 16, 1773, around the time that Hamilton entered King's College. A mob of 200 men with soot-darkened faces, roughly costumed as Mohawk Indians, crept aboard three ships in Boston Harbor, used tomahawks to smash open 342 chests of tea, and pitched the contents overboard. Another 2,000 townspeople urged them on from the docks. "This is the most magnificent moment of all," John Adams cheered from Braintree, Massachusetts. The Boston Tea Party expressed patriotic disgust at both violated principles and eroded profits. For a time, the colonists had acquiesced to a tea tax because they had been able to smuggle in contraband tea from Holland. After Parliament manipulated duties to grant a de facto tea monopoly to the East India Company in 1773, the smugglers were thwarted and rich Boston merchants, at least those not selected as company agents, suddenly decided to make common cause with the town radicals and protest the parliamentary measures. 4 days later, Paul Revere galloped breathlessly into New York with news of the Boston uprising. Troup contended that Hamilton rushed off to Boston to engage in first-hand reportage. This seems unlikely for a new student, but he may well have rushed into print. As a former clerk acquainted with import duties, contraband goods, and European trade policies, Hamilton was handed a tailor-made issue that wasn't entirely new to him. The West Indian Islands had felt the distant repercussions of the Stamp Act protests and other thwarted attempts by Britain to tax the colonists. The first political piece which Hamilton wrote, recalled Troup, was on the destruction of the tea at Boston, in which he aimed to show that the destruction was both necessary and politic. This anonymous salvo may have been the defense and destruction of the tea, published in John Holt's New York Journal. In Troup's telling, Hamilton assuaged the keen anxieties of merchants alarmed by the assault on property. Such reassurance was especially timely after New York hosted its own tea party on April 22, 1774, when a group of sea captains, led by Alexander McDougall and decked out in Mohawk dress, stormed the British ship London and chucked its tea chests into the deep. The enraged British lost all patience with their American brethren after the Boston Tea Party and enacted punitive measures. One especially irate member of Parliament, Charles Vann, said Boston should be obliterated like Carthage. "I'm of the opinion you will never meet with that proper obedience to the laws of this country until you have destroyed that nest of locusts." By May 1774, news arrived that England had retaliated with the coercive or intolerable acts. These draconian measures shut down Boston's port until the colonists paid for the spilled tea. They also curbed popular assemblies, restricted trial by jury, subjected Massachusetts to ham-handed military rule, and guaranteed that the Boston streets would be blanketed with British troops in an overpowering show of force. On May 13th, General Thomas Gage, the new military commander, arrived in Boston with four regiments to enforce these acts, which dealt a crippling blow to the free-spirited maritime town. The British response triggered a still tenuous unity among colonists who balked at the notion that Parliament could impose taxes without their consent. Until this point, the colonies had been tantamount to separate countries, joined by little sense of common mission or identity. Now, committees of correspondence in each colony began to communicate with one another, issuing calls for a trade embargo against British goods and summoning a Continental Congress in Philadelphia in September. Even in rabidly Anglophile New York, the political atmosphere by late spring was as full of uproar as if it was besieged by a foreign force, said one observer. These were stirring days for Hamilton, who must have been constantly distracted from his studies by rallies, petitions, broadsides, and handbills. In choosing New York's delegates for the first Continental Congress, a feud arose between hardline protesters, who favored a boycott of British goods, and moderate burghers who criticized such measures as overly provocative and self-defeating. To beat the drum for a boycott, the militant Sons of Liberty, members of a secret society first convened to flout the Stamp Act, gathered a mass meeting on the afternoon of July 6, 1774. It took place at the grassy common near King's College, sometimes called the Fields, in the shadow of the towering Liberty Pole. Alexander MacDougall chaired the meeting and introduced resolutions condemning British sanctions against Massachusetts. The rich folklore surrounding this pivotal event in Hamilton's life suggests that his speech came about spontaneously, possibly prompted by somebody in the crowd. After mounting the platform, the slight, boyish speaker started out haltingly, then caught fire in a burst of oratory. If true to his later style, Hamilton gained energy as he spoke. He endorsed the Boston Tea Party, deplored the closure of Boston's port, endorsed colonial unity against unfair taxation, and came down four square for a boycott of British goods. In his triumphant peroration, he said such actions will prove the salvation of North America and her liberties. Otherwise, fraud, power, and the most odious oppression will rise triumphant over right, justice, social happiness, and freedom. When his speech ended, the crowd stood transfixed in silence, staring at this spellbinding young orator before it erupted in a sustained ovation. "It is a collegian," people whispered to one another. "It is a collegian." Hamilton, 19, looked young for his age, which made his performance seem even more inspired. From that moment on, he was treated as a youthful hero of the cause and recognized as such by Alexander MacDougall, John Lamb, Marinus Willett, and other chieftains of the Sons of Liberty. It is worth remarking that at this juncture, Hamilton sided with the radical camp, along with the artisans and mechanics, rather than with the more circumspect merchant class he later led. Hamilton had immigrated to North America to gratify his ambition and successfully seized the opportunity to distinguish himself. Both then and forever after, the poor boy from the West Indies commanded attention with the force and fervor of his words. Once Hamilton was initiated into the cause of American liberty, his life acquired an even more headlong pace that never slackened. As rumors of the militant commotion at the Common filtered back to the college, Dr. Miles Cooper must have been appalled that the orphan whom he had treated so indulgently was now fraternizing with disreputable elements. Cooper maligned the Sons of Liberty as the sons of licentiousness, faction, and confusion. The situation was an awkward one for Cooper, who was tugging his forelock at royal authority while Hamilton was thumbing his nose at it. Exactly 2 months before, the college president had published an obsequious open letter to William Tryon, the departing royal governor, that was a classic of unctuous prose and that concluded, "We can only say that as long as the society shall have any existence and wherever its voice can extend, the name of Tryon will be celebrated among the worthiest of its benefactors." Hamilton contended that he was greatly attached to Cooper, and in ordinary times he might have been a fond disciple. Cooper was a witty, published poet, a Greek and Latin scholar, and a worldly bachelor with Epicurean tastes. In a portrait by John Singleton Copley, he has a smooth, well-fed face and stares sideways at the viewer in a smug, self-assured manner. On the tiny King's faculty, it was Cooper who likely tutored Hamilton in Latin, Greek, theology, and moral philosophy. Cooper had been recommended for the King's presidency by the Archbishop of Canterbury and was, in many respects, an outstanding choice. In little more than a decade, he had inaugurated a medical school, enlarged the library, added professors, and even launched an art collection. Like John Witherspoon, he boasted a roster of distinguished pupils, including John Jay, Robert R. Livingston, Gouverneur Morris, Benjamin Moore, and Hamilton. In 1774, Cooper had intensified the overriding quest of his presidency for a charter that would convert King's College into a royal university. Then the revolution blasted his hopes. He found the revolt at first an irritant, then an outrage, then a mortal threat to his ambitions. He could not afford to be a neutral bystander and began to flay the protesters in caustic essays, claiming that the tea tax was exceedingly mild. "The people of Boston are a crooked and perverse generation and deserve to forfeit their charter," he wrote. With such retrograde views, he became one of New York's most despised loyalists and was increasingly assailed by his students. Samuel Clossy also grew disgusted with the turmoil and returned to the British Isles. Colonial resistance began to assume a more organized shape. By late August 1774, all the colonies save Georgia had picked their delegates to the First Continental Congress. The New York delegates, among them John Jay and James Duane, departed for Philadelphia amid stirring fanfare. One newspaper reported, "They were accompanied to the place of their departure by a number of the inhabitants, with colors flying and music playing and loud huzzas at the end of each street." It was not an assembly of dogmatic extremists who sat in Windsor chairs for 6 weeks in the red and black brick structure known as Carpenter's Hall. Far from being bent on fighting for independence, these law-abiding delegates offered up a public prayer that war might be averted. They reaffirmed their loyalty as British subjects, hoped for a peaceful accommodation with London, and scrupulously honored legal forms. Yet there were limits to their patience. The Congress formed a continental association to enforce a total trade embargo. No exports, no imports, not even consumption of British wares, until the coercive acts were repealed. Every community was instructed to assemble committees to police the ban, and when New York chose its members that November, many of Hamilton's friends, including Hercules Mulligan, appeared among their numbers. Even though John Adams had found Jay and Duane far too timid for his tastes, the Continental Congress's actions stunned Tory sentiment in New York. For Miles Cooper, the meeting had been a satanic den of sedition, which he acidly condemned in two widely read pamphlets. He informed the startled colonists that subjects of Great Britain are the happiest people on earth. Far from criticizing Parliament, he maintained that the behavior of the colonies has been intolerable. He then poured vitriol on the Congress's initiatives. "To think of succeeding by force of arms or by starving the nation into compliance is a proof of shameful ignorance, pride, and stupidity." Like many people, he scorned the notion that the colonies could ever defeat Britain's invincible military. "To believe America able to withstand England is a dreadful infatuation." Miles Cooper was not the only Anglican clergyman in New York to rail against the Continental Congress. He formed part of a loyalist literary clique that included Charles Inglis, later rector of Trinity Church, and Samuel Seabury, the Anglican rector of the town of Westchester. Seabury was a redoubtable man of massive physique and learned mind. Educated at Yale and Oxford, he was very pompous and wrote prose that bristled with energetic intelligence. Because Westchester had been granted special privileges by a royal charter, local farmers felt especially threatened by the trade embargo. So after the Continental Congress adjourned, Seabury, with the full knowledge of Miles Cooper, launched a series of pamphlets under the pseudonym A Westchester Farmer. The title cunningly echoed John Dickinson's famous polemic against parliamentary taxation, Letters from a Farmer in Pennsylvania. Seabury's blistering essays reviled the officers of the new Continental Association as a venomous brood of scorpions who would sting us to death, and he suggested that they be greeted with hickory sticks. He appealed cleverly to farmers by warning that they would be the major casualties of any trade boycott against Britain. If merchants could not import goods from Britain, would they not then hike their prices to farmers? As he wrote, "From the day the exports from this province are stopped, the farmers may date the commencement of their ruin. Can you live without money?" After the first installment of Seabury's invective was published by James Rivington in the New York Gazetteer, the paper reported a febrile patriotic response, especially among Hamilton's newfound companions. "We can assure the public that at a late meeting of exotics, styled the Sons of Liberty, the farmer essay was introduced, and after a few pages being read to the company, they agreed to commit it to the flames without the benefit of clergy, though many, very many indeed, could neither write nor read." To drive home the point, some copies were tarred and feathered and slapped on whipping posts. Nonetheless, the essay made a huge popular impression and demonstrated that the patriots were being outgunned by Tory pamphleteers and needed a literary champion of their own. Seabury gave Hamilton what he always needed for his best work, a hard, strong position to contest. The young man gravitated to controversy, indeed gloried in it. In taking on Seabury, Hamilton might have suspected, and may well have enjoyed, the little secret that he was combating an Anglican cleric in Miles Cooper's inner circle. He had to tread stealthily and keep his name out of print. Most political essays at the time were published anonymously anyway. Eager to make his mark, Hamilton was motivated by a form of ambition much esteemed in the 18th century, what he later extolled as the love of fame, the ruling passion of the noblest minds, which would prompt a man to plan and undertake extensive and arduous enterprises for the public benefit. Ambition was reckless if inspired by purely selfish motives, but laudable if guided by great principles. In this, his first great performance in print, Hamilton placed his ambition at the service of lofty ideals. On December 15, 1774, the New York Gazetteer ran an advertisement for a newly published pamphlet entitled A Full Vindication of the Measures of the Congress that promised to answer the Westchester farmer. The farmer's sophistry would be exposed, his cavils confuted, his artifices detected, and his wit ridiculed. This 35-page essay had been written in 2 or 3 weeks by Hamilton, as he entered the fray with all the grandiloquence and learning at his disposal. He showed himself proficient at elegant insults, an essential literary talent at the time, and possessing a precocious knowledge of history, philosophy, politics, economics, and law. In retrospect, it was clear that he had found his calling as a fearless, swashbuckling intellectual warrior who excelled in bare-knuckled controversy. By the time of A Full Vindication, Hamilton had clearly assumed the coloring of his environment. Few immigrants have renounced their past more unequivocally or adopted their new country more wholeheartedly. "I am neither merchant nor farmer," he now wrote, just a year and a half after leaving St. Croix. "I address you because I wish well to my country, New York." Hamilton reviewed the Boston Tea Party and the punitive measures that had ensued in Boston, including license of the murder of its inhabitants by British troops. Hamilton supported the Tea Party culprits and faulted the British for punishing the whole province instead of just the perpetrators. He voiced the increasingly popular complaints about taxation without representation and defended the trade embargo, insisting that England would suffer drastic harm. Sounding more like the later Jefferson than the later Hamilton, he evoked an England burdened by debt and taxes and corrupted by luxuries. In many places, a full vindication was verbose and repetitive. What foreshadowed Hamilton's mature style was the lawyerly fashion in which he grounded his argument in natural law, colonial charters, and the British Constitution. He already showed little patience with halfway measures that prolonged problems instead of solving them crisply. When the political salvation of any community is depending, it is incumbent upon those who were set up as its guardians to embrace such measures as have justice, vigor, and a probability of success to recommend them. Most impressive was Hamilton's shrewd insight into the psychology of power. Of the British Prime Minister, Lord North, he wrote with exceptional acuity. The Premier has advanced too far to recede with safety. He is deeply interested to execute his purpose, if possible. In common life, to retract an error, even in the beginning, is no easy task. Perseverance confirms us in it and rivets the difficulty. To this we may add that disappointment and opposition inflame the minds of men and attach them still more to their mistakes. After Seabury rebutted a full vindication, Hamilton struck back with The Farmer Refuted, an 80-page tour de force that Rivington brought out on February 23, 1775. More than twice the length of its predecessor, this second essay betrayed a surer grasp of politics and economics. Seabury had mocked Hamilton's maiden performance and now suffered the consequences. "Such is my opinion of your abilities as a critic," Hamilton addressed him directly, "that I very much prefer your disapprobation to your applause." As if Seabury were the young upstart and not vice versa, Hamilton taunted his riposte as puerile and fallacious, and stated that, "I will venture to pronounce it one of the most ludicrous performances which has been exhibited to public view during all the present controversy." This slashing style of attack would make Hamilton the most feared polemicist in America, but it won him enemies as well as admirers. Unlike Franklin or Jefferson, he never learned to subdue his opponents with a light touch or a sly, artful, understated turn of phrase. Like most colonists, Hamilton still hoped for amity with England and complained that the colonists were being denied the full liberties of British subjects. In justifying American defiance of British taxation, he elaborated the fashionable argument that the colonies owed their allegiance to the British king, not to Parliament. The point was critical, for if the colonies were linked only to the king, they could, theoretically, wriggle free from parliamentary control while creating some form of Commonwealth status in the British Empire. Indeed, Hamilton cast himself as a warm advocate for limited monarchy and an unfeigned well-wisher to the present royal family. In what became his trademark style, he displayed exhaustive research, tracing royal charters for North America back to Queen Elizabeth and showing that no powers had been reserved to Parliament. In one glowing passage, Hamilton invoked the colonists' natural rights. "The sacred rights of mankind are not to be rummaged for among old parchments or musty records. They are written, as with a sunbeam, in the whole volume of human nature by the hand of the divinity itself, and can never be erased or obscured by mortal power." These lines echo John Dickinson, who had written that the essential rights to happiness are bestowed by God, not man. "They are not annexed to us by parchments and seals." Hamilton added beauty and rhythm to the expression. Clearly, Hamilton was reading the skeptical Scottish philosopher David Hume, and he quoted his view that in framing a government, every man ought to be supposed a knave and to have no other end in all his actions but private interests. The task of government was not to stop selfish striving, a hopeless task, but to harness it for the public good. In starting to outline the contours of his own vision of government, Hamilton was spurred by Hume's dark vision of human nature, which corresponded to his own. At one point, while talking about the advantages that England derived from colonial trade, he said, "And let me tell you, in this selfish, rapacious world, a little discretion is, at worst, only a venial sin." That chilling aside, "a selfish, rapacious world," speaks volumes about the darkness of Hamilton's upbringing. With The Farmer Refuted, the West Indian student became an eloquent booster of his chosen country and asserted the need for unity to resist British oppression. "If the sword of oppression be permitted to lop off one limb without opposition, reiterated strokes will soon dismember the whole body." He already took the long view of American destiny, seeing that the colonies would someday overtake the mother country in economic power. If we look forward to a period not far distant, we shall perceive that the productions of our country will infinitely exceed the demands which Great Britain and her connections can possibly have for them. And as we shall then be greatly advanced in population, our wants will be proportionably increased. Here, in embryonic form, is his vision of the vast, diversified economy that was to emerge after independence. The Farmer Refuted was a bravura performance, flashing with prophetic insights. While the British disputed that America could win a war of independence, Hamilton accurately predicted that France and Spain would aid the colonies. The 20-year-old student anticipated the scrappy, opportunistic military strategy that would defeat the British. Let it be remembered that there are no large plains for the two armies to meet in and decide the conquest. The circumstances of our country put it in our power to evade a pitched battle. It will be better policy to harass and exhaust the soldiery by frequent skirmishes and incursions than to take the open field with them, by which means they would have the full benefit of their superior regularity and skills. Americans are better qualified for that kind of fighting which is most adapted to this country than regular troops. This was Washington's strategy, compressed into a nutshell and articulated even before the fighting broke out at Lexington and Concord. This was more than just precocious knowledge. This was intuitive judgment of the highest order. As rumors went around that Hamilton had authored the two Farmer essays, many New Yorkers, Miles Cooper included, dismissed the notion as preposterous. "I remember that in a conversation I once had with Dr. Cooper," said Robert Troop, "he insisted that Mr. Jay must be the author, it being absurd to imagine that so young a man as Hamilton could have written it." Others attributed the pieces to much more established figures, such as William Livingston. Hamilton must have been flattered by the fuss and his literary club deeply amused. In a city with a dearth of Republican pamphleteers, Hamilton represented an important recruit to the cause. He had demonstrated inimitable speed. The two Farmer essays totaled 60,000 words, supreme confidence in his views, and an easy, sophisticated grasp of the issues. He was to be a true child of the Revolution, growing up along with his new country and gaining in strength and wisdom as the hostilities mounted. Chapter 4. The Pen and the Sword. By the time Hamilton wrote The Farmer Refuted, the British Parliament had declared Massachusetts to be in a state of rebellion and ratified the king's unswerving determination to adopt all measures necessary to compel obedience. On the night of April 18, 1775, 800 British troops marched out of Boston to capture Samuel Adams and John Hancock and seize a stockpile of Patriot munitions in Concord. As they passed Lexington, they encountered a motley battalion of armed farmers known as Minutemen, and in the ensuing exchange of gunfire, the British killed 8 colonists and then 2 more in Concord. As the Redcoats retreated helter-skelter to Boston, they were riddled by sniper fire that erupted from behind hedges, stone walls, and fences, leaving a bloody trail of 273 British casualties versus 95 dead or wounded for the Patriots. The news reached New York within 4 days, and a mood of insurrection promptly overtook the city. People gathered at taverns and on street corners to ponder events while Tories quaked. One of the latter, Judge Thomas Jones, watched exultant rebels storm by in the street, with drums beating and colors flying, attended by a mob of Negroes, boys, sailors, and pickpockets, inviting all mankind to take up arms in defense of the injured rights and liberties of America, he said. The newly emboldened Sons of Liberty streamed down to the East River docks, pilfered ships bound for British troops in Boston, then emptied the City Hall arsenal of its muskets, bayonets, and cartridge boxes, grabbing 1,000 weapons in all. Armed with this cash, volunteer militia companies sprang up overnight, as they did throughout the colonies. However much the British might deride these ragtag citizen soldiers, they conducted their business in earnest. Inflamed by the astonishing news from Massachusetts, Hamilton was that singular intellectual who picked up a musket as fast as a pen. Nicholas Fish recalled that immediately after the Battle of Lexington, Hamilton attached himself to one of the uniform companies of militia then forming for the defense of the country by the patriotic young men of this city, under the command of Captain Fleming, in which he devoted much time, attending regularly all the parades and performing tours of duty with promptitude and zeal. Fish and Troop were among the diligent cadre of King's College volunteers who drilled before classes each morning in the churchyard of nearby St. Paul's Chapel. Their drillmaster was Edward Fleming, who had served in a British regiment and married into the prominent De Peyster family, but was still warmly attached to the American side. A sturdy disciplinarian, Fleming was a man after Hamilton's own heart. Hamilton's son said that the fledgling volunteer company was named the Hearts of Oak, although military roles identify the group as the Corsicans. The young recruits marched briskly past tombstones with the motto, "Liberty or Death," stitched across their round leather caps. On short, snug green jackets, they also sported, for good measure, red tin hearts that announced God and our right. Hamilton approached this daily routine with the same perfectionist ardor that he exhibited in his studies. Robert Troup stressed the military spirit infused into Hamilton and noted that he was constant in his attendance and very ambitious of improvement. Hamilton, never one to fumble an opportunity, embarked on a comprehensive military education. With his absorbent mind, he mastered infantry drills, pored over volumes on military tactics, and learned the rudiments of gunnery and pyrotechnics from a veteran bombardier. Despite the physical delicacy that Hugh Knox had observed, there was a peculiar doggedness about this young man, as if he were already in training for something far beyond humble infantry duty. On April 24th, a huge throng of patriots, some 8,000 strong, massed in front of City Hall. While radicals grew giddy with excitement, many terrified Tory merchants began to book passage for England. The next day, an anonymous handbill blamed Miles Cooper and four other obnoxious gentlemen for the patriotic deaths in Massachusetts and said the moment had passed for symbolic gestures, such as burning Tories in effigy. "The injury you have done to your country cannot admit of reparation," these five loyalists were warned. "Fly for your lives or anticipate your doom by becoming your own executioners." This blatant death threat was signed 3 millions. A defiant Miles Cooper stuck to his college post. After a demonstration on the night of May 10th, hundreds of protesters armed with clubs and heated by a heady brew of political rhetoric and strong drink descended on King's College, ready to inflict rough justice on Miles Cooper. Hercules Mulligan recalled that Cooper was a Tory and an obnoxious man, and the mob went to the college with the intention of tarring and feathering him or riding him upon a rail. Nicholas Ogden, a King's alumnus, saw the angry mob swarming toward the college and raced ahead to Cooper's room, urging the president to scramble out a back window. Because Hamilton and Troup shared a room near Cooper's quarters, Ogden also alerted them to the approaching mob. Whereupon Hamilton instantly resolved to take his stand on the stairs, that is, the outer stoop, in front of the doctor's apartment, and there to detain the mob as long as he could by a harangue, in order to gain the doctor the more time for his escape, Troop later recorded. After the mob knocked down the gate and surged toward the residence, Hamilton launched into an impassioned speech, telling the vociferous protesters that their conduct, instead of promoting their cause, would disgrace and injure the glorious cause of liberty. One account has the slightly deaf Cooper poking his head from an upper-story window and observing Hamilton gesticulating on the stoop below. He mistakenly thought that his pupil was inciting the crowd instead of pacifying them, and shouted, "Don't mind what he says, he's crazy." Another account has Cooper shouting at the ruffians, "Don't believe anything Hamilton says, he's a little fool." The more plausible version is that Cooper had long since vanished, having scampered away in his nightgown on Ogden's warning. Hamilton likely knew he couldn't stop the intruders, but he won the vital minutes necessary for Cooper to clamber over a back fence and rush down to the Hudson. Afraid for his life, Cooper meandered along the shore all night. The next day, he boarded a man-of-war bound for England, where he resumed his tirades against the colonists from the safety of a study. Among other things, he published a melodramatic poem about his escape. He told how the rabble, a murderous band, had burst into his room. "And whilst their curses load my head, with piercing steel they probe the bed, and thirst for human gore. This image of the president set upon by bloodthirsty rebels was more satisfying than the banal truth that he cravenly ran off half-dressed into the night. Cooper never saw Hamilton again and wept copiously when England lost the revolution. He could not resist grumbling in his will that all my affairs have been shattered to pieces by this abominable rebellion. Of all the incidents in Hamilton's early life in America, his spontaneous defense of Miles Cooper was probably the most telling. It showed that he could separate personal honor from political convictions and presaged a recurring theme of his career, the superiority of forgiveness over revolutionary vengeance. Hamilton had shown exemplary courage. Beyond risking a terrible beating, he had taken the chance that he would sacrifice his heroic stature among the Sons of Liberty. But Hamilton always expressed himself frankly, no matter what the consequences. Most of all, the episode captured the contradictory impulses struggling inside this complex young man, a committed revolutionary, with a profound dread that popular sentiment would boil over into dangerous excess. Even amid an insurrection that he supported, he fretted about the damage to constituted authority and worried about mob rule. Like other founding fathers, Hamilton would have preferred a stately revolution enacted decorously in courtrooms and parliamentary chambers by gifted orators in powdered wigs. The American Revolution was to succeed because it was undertaken by skeptical men who knew that the same passions that toppled tyrannies could be applied to destructive ends. In a moment of acute anxiety a year earlier, John Adams had wondered what would happen if the multitude, the vulgar, the herd, the rabble, maintained such open defiance of authority. For Hamilton and other patriotic New Yorkers, the late spring of 1775 was a season of pride, dread, hope, and confusion. When New England delegates to the Second Continental Congress swept through town en route to Philadelphia on May 6th, thousands of New Yorkers jammed rooftops, stoops, and doorways to roar their approval above an incessant clanging of church bells. Since the old Loyalist Assembly in New York had refused to send delegates to the First Continental Congress, it was disbanded and replaced by a New York Provincial Congress. This new body pieced together a slate of delegates to send to Philadelphia, including Philip Schuyler, Hamilton's future father-in-law, and George Clinton, his future political nemesis. As the Congress convened in the Pennsylvania State House, today's Independence Hall, on May 10th, most colonists still prayed for a peaceful resolution of the standoff, though armed conflict now seemed inevitable. The Second Continental Congress lacked many of the prerequisites of an authentic government, an army, a currency, taxing power, yet it evolved in pell-mell fashion into the first government of the United States. Its most pressing task was to appoint a commander-in-chief. All eyes turned to a strapping, reticent Virginian who carried himself with unusual poise and wore a colonel's uniform to advertise his experience in the French and Indian War. One congressman said that George Washington was no harum-scarum, ranting, swearing fellow, but sober, steady, and calm. On June 15th, Washington, 43, was named head of the Continental Army for reasons that transcended talent and experience. Since the fighting had thus far been restricted to New England, the choice of a Virginian signaled that this was a crusade of unified colonies, not some regional squabble. Also, with one-fifth of the population of the colonies, Virginia felt entitled to a leadership role, and the selection of Washington was the first of many efforts by the North to please and placate the South. 2 days later, at Bunker Hill, or rather Breed's Hill, north of Boston, a battle took place that hardly seemed at first like a patriotic victory. Americans were flushed from their elevated fortification, and more than 400 were killed or wounded. Nevertheless, the patriotic soldiers showed great coolness under fire, and the British suffered more than 1,000 casualties, including dozens of officers. "The dead lay as thick as sheep in a fold," said Colonel John Stark. This first formal battle of the Revolution demolished the myth of British invincibility and raised for the first time the question of just how many deaths the mother country would tolerate to subjugate the colonies. The British were unhinged by the colonists' unorthodox fighting style and shocking failure to abide by gentlemanly rules of engagement. One scandalized British soldier complained that the American riflemen conceal themselves behind trees, etc., till an opportunity presents itself of taking a shot at our advanced sentries, which done, they immediately retreat. What an unfair method of carrying on a war. Following this battle, George Washington stopped in New York on his way to Cambridge, Massachusetts, to assume his command. On June 25th, he crossed the Hudson on the Hoboken Ferry, then proceeded along Broadway in a carriage pulled by a team of white horses, the triumphant procession moving grandly past King's College. On that glorious summer afternoon, Alexander Hamilton stood unnoticed among the delirious spectators, unaware that within 2 years he would serve as chief aide to the general he now observed for the first time. Probably accompanied by Major General Philip Schuyler, Washington sped by with a touch of magnificence, a purple sash across his blue uniform, and a ceremonial plume sprouting from his hat. Hamilton had not been idle while the Second Continental Congress deliberated and urged Canadian colonists to join the fray. On the day that Washington was appointed top commander, Hamilton published the first of two letters in Rivington's paper assailing the Quebec Act, passed the previous year. The second article appeared just 3 days before Washington's visit. The act extended Quebec's boundaries south to the Ohio River and guaranteed full religious freedom to French-Canadian Catholics. For the Patriots, this did not reflect British tolerance so much as the frightening imposition of French civil law and Roman Catholicism in a neighboring frontier area. Hamilton discerned a sinister intent behind Britain's bid to enlist the aid of the Roman Catholic clergy in Canada. This act develops the dark designs of the ministry more fully than anything they have done, and shows that they have formed a systematic project of absolute power. If Hamilton displayed some atavistic Huguenot fear of popery, he also sounded a theme that was to resonate straight through the Revolution and beyond, that the best government posture toward religion was one of passive tolerance, not active promotion of an established church. On July 5th, the Second Continental Congress made one final feeble effort to ward off further hostilities when it endorsed the Olive Branch Petition, urging a negotiated solution to the conflict with England. The document professed loyalty to the king and tactfully blamed his artful and cruel ministers. When the haughty King George III did not deign to answer this conciliatory message, his frosty rigidity demoralized congressional moderates and guaranteed intensified military preparations. On August 23rd, the king issued a royal proclamation that his American subjects had proceeded to open and avowed rebellion. The world's most powerful nation had now pledged itself irrevocably to breaking the resistance of its unruly overseas colonists. By coincidence, on that same night of August 23rd, Alexander Hamilton got his first unforgettable taste of British military might. Everyone knew that Manhattan, encircled by water, was vulnerable to the Royal Armada and would not be defensible for long without a navy. So when the British warship Asia appeared in the harbor that summer, it proved an effective instrument of terror. The New York Provincial Congress worried that the 24 cannon posted at Fort George at the tip of the battery might be seized by the British. Hamilton, joined by 15 other King's College volunteers, signed up for a hazardous operation to drag the heavy artillery to safety under the Liberty Pole on the Common. College lore later claimed that two of the salvaged cannon were buried under the campus green. Lashing the cannon with ropes, Hamilton and his fellow students rescued more than 10 big guns before a barge from the Asia, moored near the shore, began to strafe them with fire. The Patriots, possibly including Hamilton, returned fire as the barge darted back to the Asia. The warship then let loose a thunderous broadside of grapeshot and cannonballs that blew a big hole in the roof of Francis Tavern and sent thousands of panicky residents fleeing from their beds and screaming into the streets. As in his defense of Miles Cooper, the intrepid Hamilton displayed unusual sang-froid. "The Asia fired upon the city," wrote Hercules Mulligan, "and I recollect well that Mr. Hamilton was there, for I was engaged in hauling off one of the cannon when Mr. H. came up and gave me his musket to hold, and he took hold of the rope." After Hamilton disposed of his ordnance, he ran into Mulligan again and asked for his musket back, only to be told that the tailor had left it down at the battery, the spot most exposed to fierce shelling from the Asia. I told him where I had left it, Mulligan continued, and he went for it, notwithstanding that the firing continued with as much unconcern as if the vessel had not been there. During an autumn term that allowed little time for leisure, Hamilton found himself in a new predicament over the progressively more precarious situation of James Rivington, the New York Gazetteer publisher. The son of a prosperous London bookseller, Rivington was an elegant but combative man who wore a silver wig. When he inaugurated his newspaper in 1773 at the foot of Wall Street, he prided himself on his political neutrality and swore that he would be receptive to all viewpoints. As shown by his relationship with Hamilton, he did not shrink from questioning Tory dogma. Nevertheless, with the passage of time, Tory opinion predominated in his paper. Rivington took an especially harsh tone toward the Sons of Liberty, with their rough-hewn working-class followers, and singled out their leaders, Alexander McDougall and Isaac Sears, for special abuse. By September 1774, Sears retaliated with scathing letters to Rivington. "I believe you to be either an ignorant, impudent pretender to what you do not understand," he wrote, "or a base, servile tool, ready to do the dirty work of any knave who will purchase you." Pretty soon, the rival New York Journal ran lengthy lists of patriotic subscribers who felt so betrayed by Rivington that they had canceled their subscriptions to his paper. Rivington's days were numbered after Lexington and Concord. The same mob that chased Miles Cooper from King's proceeded to attack the petrified Rivington, who spent the next 10 days in seclusion aboard the man-of-war Kingfisher. Though he returned to his print shop, his ordeal was not over. Later that summer, the New York Provincial Congress ruled that anyone aiding the enemy could be disarmed, imprisoned, or even exiled. Isaac Sears seized on this decision to be done with Rivington once and for all. Though nicknamed the King of the New York Streets, Sears was not a plebeian hero, but a prosperous skipper who had worked the West Indian trade and amassed a small fortune as a privateer during the French and Indian War. On November 19th, Sears gathered up a militia of nearly 100 horsemen in Connecticut, kidnapped the Reverend Samuel Seabury, and terrorized his prisoner's family in Westchester before parading his humiliated Tory trophy through New Haven. Confined under military guard, Seabury refused to confess that he was the Westchester farmer whose essays had provoked Hamilton's celebrated rebuttal. Sears's little army, turning south, then swooped down in a surprising raid on Rivington's print shop in Manhattan, planning to put it out of business. Because Hamilton poured out his anguish afterward in a letter to John Jay, this is one of the better documented episodes of his King's College days. We also know about the fracas from another source. Probably encouraged by his old mentor, Hugh Knox, Hamilton seems to have mailed unsigned dispatches from New York to the Royal Danish American Gazette. These hitherto undiscovered articles give a more detailed glimpse of his life in the early days of the rebellion and fill major gaps in the sketchy documentary record of Hamilton's early career. In a report on Rivington, the anonymous correspondent wrote, "The contents of all last week's New York Gazetteer occasioned Mr. Rivington, the printer, to be surprised and surrounded on the 23rd of November by 75 of the Connecticut Light Horse, with firelocks and fixed bayonets, who burst into his house between 12 and 1 o'clock at noon, and totally destroyed all his types and put an entire stop to his business, and reduced him at upwards of 50 years of age to the sad necessity of beginning the world again. The astonished citizens beheld the whole scene without affording the persecuted proscribed printer the least assistance. The printing of the New York Gazetteer will be discontinued until America shall be blessed with the restoration of good government." Although the author of this dispatch was anonymous, who else but Hamilton would have filed such a dispatch to St. Croix? From Hercules Mulligan, we know that the one bystander who had the pluck to rise to Rivington's defense was Hamilton himself. When Rivington's press was attacked by a company from the eastward, Mr. H., indignant that our neighbors should intrude upon our rights, although the press was considered a Tory one, he went to the place, addressed the people present, and offered if any others would join him to prevent these intruders from taking the type away. As with the mob assault against Miles Cooper, the scene at Rivington's became stamped on Hamilton's memory, and his horror at such mob disorder foreshadowed his fearful reaction to the French Revolution. Several days after Sears's men pillaged Rivington's shop, Hamilton wrote to John Jay and acknowledged that Rivington's press had been dangerous and pernicious, and that the man himself was detestable. Nevertheless, he felt obliged to condemn the lawless nature of the action. In times of such commotion as the present, while the passions of men are worked up to an uncommon pitch, there is great danger of fatal extremes. The same state of the passions which fits the multitude, who have not a sufficient stock of reason and knowledge to guide them, for opposition to tyranny and oppression, very naturally leads them to a contempt and disregard of all authority. The due medium is hardly to be found among the more intelligent. It is almost impossible among the unthinking populace. When the minds of these are loosened from their attachment to ancient establishments and courses, they seem to grow giddy and are apt more or less to run into anarchy. Clearly, this ambivalent 20-year-old favored the revolution, but also worried about the long-term effect of habitual disorder, especially among the uneducated masses. Hamilton lacked the temperament of a true blue revolutionary. He saw too clearly that greater freedom could lead to greater disorder, and by a dangerous dialectic, back to a loss of freedom. Hamilton's lifelong task was to try to straddle and resolve this contradiction, and balance liberty and order. The sequel to the print shop raid deserves mention. James Rivington was temporarily put out of business, only to be resurrected as a printer to His Majesty the King during Britain's wartime occupation of New York. Appearances could be deceiving. Even as he reviled the patriots in the Royal Gazette, Rivington was surreptitiously relaying British naval intelligence to Washington, sealed inside the covers of books he sold to patriotic spies. He was to be rewarded in the fullness of time. While Rivington had been muzzled by his critics, Hamilton himself was still gripped by the publishing itch. For an ambitious young man of a broadly literary bent, polemical broadsides fired at the British ministry presented the surest road to fame. In early January 1776, a self-taught English immigrant, Thomas Paine, who had arrived in Philadelphia 2 years earlier, provided Hamilton with a perfect model when he anonymously published Common Sense. The one-time corset maker and excise officer issued a resounding call for American independence that sold a stupendous 120,000 copies by year's end. By now, Hamilton had switched his journalistic allegiance to the stalwart Republican paper of John Holt, the New York Journal. He probably met Holt through William Livingston, who had co-founded the paper. In 1774, Holt had dropped the royal symbols from his masthead and replaced them with a well-known engraving that Ben Franklin had created to foster his Albany plan of intercolonial union 20 years before. A copperhead snake sliced into segments and accompanied by the fighting slogan, "Unite or Die." In Franklin's version, "Join or Die." Robert Troup said that Hamilton published many articles while at King's, particularly in the newspaper then edited in New York by John Holt, who was a zealous Whig. Nor had Hamilton given up on poetry. He constantly scribbled doggerel, rhyme, and satirical verse, and gave Troup a thick sheaf of these poems, which the latter proceeded to lose during the Revolution. Oddly, the otherwise thorough editors of Hamilton's papers have reprinted his essay as published by the Tory Rivington, but have omitted his collaborations with the dissident Holt. Hamilton's contemporaries knew him as the nameless scribe behind some of the New York Journal's most trenchant editorials. "I hope Mr. Hamilton continues busy," John Jay told Alexander McDougall on December 5th, 1775. "I have not received Holt's paper these 3 months, and therefore cannot judge of the progress he makes." In fact, Hamilton's contributions were evident there. From November 9th, 1775, to February 8th, 1776, the New York Journal ran 14 installments of The Monitor, probably the longest and most prominently featured string of essays that Holt printed before the Revolution. In the series, Hamilton recapitulated the central theme of his anti-farmer essays, that the colonies owed their fealty to the king, not to Parliament. Although Hamilton later retracted some of his more hot-blooded opinions, such as his opposition to standing armies, and though he may have regretted his withering mockery of statesmen, royalty, popes, and priests, many of the essays are vintage Hamilton. In The Monitor, Hamilton left many clues to his authorship. Echoing his 1769 letter to Edward Stevens, in which he bemoaned the groveling life of a clerk, He now warned his comrades against a groveling disposition that would degrade them from the rank of freemen to that of slaves. He expressed views of leadership that closely anticipate his later dicta about the need for decisive, unequivocal action. In public exigencies, there is hardly anything more prejudicial than excessive caution, timidity, and dilatoriness, as there is nothing more beneficial than vigor, enterprise, and expedition. At times, he repeated his anti-farmer essays almost verbatim, saying of the British ministry, "They have advanced too far to retreat without equal infamy and danger. Their honor, their credit, their existence as ministers, perhaps their life itself, depend upon their success in the present undertaking." Like many prolific authors, Hamilton sometimes quoted himself unwittingly. The Monitor essays reveal Hamilton as an anomalous revolutionary. At the outset, he shows the rousing optimism about the revolutionary future that is the stock in trade of radical prose. He delivers a paean to America's destiny as he prophesies that after the war the country will be elevated to a much higher pitch of grandeur, opulence, and power than we could ever attain to by a humble submission to arbitrary rule. Yet this hopefulness is hedged by a somber view of human affairs. Hamilton lauds the conduct of his countrymen, but cannot refrain from saying sardonically that it is a melancholy truth that the behavior of many among us might serve as the severest satire upon the human species. It has been a compound of inconsistency, falsehood, cowardice, selfishness, and dissimulation. Hamilton also displays a swooning fascination with martyrdom, telling the colonists that they should vow either to lead an honorable life or to meet with resignation a glorious death. This idea so bewitched him that he ended one Monitor essay with a quote from Pope's Iliad that begins, "Death is the worst, a fate which all must try, and for our country 'tis a bliss to die." Hamilton dashed off the Monitor essays at the frenetic pace of one a week, the more incredible as he was still a student and dutifully attending drills in the St. Paul's Churchyard each morning. Even this did not exhaust the scope of his activities. This peerless undergraduate had begun preliminary legal studies and was combing the superb law library at King's, steeping himself in the works of Sir William Blackstone and Sir Edward Coke. As he later said, by steady and laborious exertion, he had qualified for a bachelor's degree and was able to lay a foundation by preparatory study for the future profession of the law. Hamilton probably spent little more than 2 years at King's and never formally graduated due to the outbreak of the Revolution. By April 6, 1776, King's College, tarred by its earlier association with Miles Cooper, was commandeered by Patriot forces and put to use as a military hospital. After Hamilton published his last Monitor installment on February 8th, he parlayed his budding fame as a pamphleteer into a military appointment that perfectly suited his daydreams of martial glory. On February 18th, he sent a personal dispatch to the Royal Danish American Gazette that announced he was joining the military. The unsigned letter was filled with grim forebodings of martyrdom. "It is uncertain whether it may ever be in my power to send you another line. I am going into the army and perhaps ere long may be destined to seal with my blood the sentiments defended by my pen. Be it so, if heaven decree it. I was born to die, and my reason and conscience tell me it is impossible to die in a better or more important cause." What prompted this declaration was that the Provincial Congress had decided to raise an artillery company to defend New York, providing another chance for the upwardly mobile West Indian to excel. Like most revolutions, this one made ample room for talented outsiders. Luckily for Hamilton, Alexander McDougall was in charge of forming New York's first patriotic regiment. A fiery, pugnacious Scot and former ship captain, McDougall was yet another Presbyterian protege of William Livingston, who may have provided the introduction. While at King's, Hamilton borrowed political pamphlets from McDougall and was mortified when they were stolen from his room. On February 23rd, the Provincial Congress reported that Colonel McDougall recommended Mr. Alexander Hamilton for captain of a company of artillery. Robert Troup said that McDougall prodded John Jay, by this time William Livingston's son-in-law, to wrangle the coveted commission for Hamilton. After being examined, Hamilton received the assignment on March 14, 1776. When doubts arose about this student's fitness to lead an artillery company, McDougall and Jay persuasively overcame them. Right before Hamilton received his appointment, he was approached by Elias Boudinot on behalf of Lord Stirling, who had been elevated to Brigadier General and desired Hamilton as his military aide. The headstrong Hamilton shrank from being subordinate to anyone and rebuffed an offer that would have tempted his peers. Boudinot informed a disappointed Stirling that Hamilton had accepted an artillery command and was therefore denied the pleasure of attending your lordship's person as brigade major. Hercules Mulligan contended that Hamilton's appointment as artillery captain was premised on the condition that he would muster 30 men. Mulligan bragged that he and Hamilton recruited 25 the first afternoon alone. Hamilton assumed an almost paternal responsibility for the 68 men who eventually came under his command. Some of them were illiterate and entered marks instead of signatures into the so-called paybook, where Hamilton kept track of their food, clothing, pay, and discipline. According to tradition, he took money from his St. Croix subscription fund and used it to equip his company. He later wrote, "Military pride is to be excited and kept up by military parade. No time ought to be lost in teaching the recruits the use of arms." The 21-year-old captain became a popular leader known for sharing hardships with his gunners and bombardiers. He was sensitive to iniquities and lobbied to get the same pay and rations for his men as their counterparts in the Continental Army. As a firm believer in meritocracy, he favored promotion from within his company, a policy adopted by the New York Provincial Congress. His subordinates remembered him as tough but fair-minded. Years later, one of them retained Hamilton as a lawyer, even though he had become a vocal political enemy. When Hamilton questioned the wisdom of this, the ex-soldier replied, "I served in your company during the war, and I know you will do me justice in spite of my rudeness." Throughout his career, Hamilton was fastidious about military dress, insisting that his men be properly attired. "Nothing is more necessary than to stimulate the vanity of soldiers," he later wrote. "To this end, a smart dress is essential. When not attended to, the soldier is exposed to ridicule and humiliation." His men wore blue coats with brass buttons and buff collars and white shoulder belts strapped diagonally across their chests. Within 4 months, he had secured 75 pairs of buckskin breeches for his men and personally advanced them money if needed. Hamilton's company looked and acted the part. "As soon as his company was raised," said Troop, "he proceeded with indefatigable pains to perfect it in every branch of discipline and duty, and it was not long before it was esteemed the most beautiful model of discipline in the whole army." Later on, as a major general, Hamilton instructed his officers on the need to be personally involved in drilling and training their men. Hamilton betrayed none of the novice's typical air of slipshod indecision and made a profound impression on several senior military figures, who joined his swelling circle of admirers. One day, General Nathaniel Greene, an ex-Quaker and former ironmonger from Rhode Island, was crossing the common when Hamilton caught his eye. He was struck by how smartly this young man put his troops through their parade exercises and paused to chat with him. He then invited Hamilton to dinner and was thunderstruck by his immense military knowledge. The largely self-educated Greene was well-placed to appreciate Hamilton's instant expertise, for his own military background was restricted to 2 years of militia duty. Most of what he knew about war was also gleaned from books. "His knowledge was intuitive," Artillery Chief Henry Knox later said of Greene. "He came to us the rawest and most untutored human being I ever met with, but in less than 12 months he was equal in military knowledge to any general officer in the army." George Washington valued Nathaniel Greene above all his other generals, and it was likely Greene who first touted Hamilton's merits to Washington. Like Lord Stirling, Greene may even have offered Hamilton a job as his military aide. If so, Hamilton again spurned a general's offer. After Boston fell to the Continental Army in March, a shock for the British and a tonic to patriotic spirits, New York loomed as the next battlefront, and the city braced for impending invasion. Hamilton had already informed his distant St. Croix readers, "This city is at present evacuated by above one half of its inhabitants under the influence of a general panic." Starting in March, Lord Stirling had supervised 4,000 men who sealed off major streets and strung a network of batteries and earthworks across Manhattan from the Hudson to the East River. Hamilton's company constructed a small fort with 12 cannon on the high ground of Bayard's Hill near the present-day intersection of Canal and Mulberry Streets. In April, Washington came down from New England to oversee military preparations in New York and employed as his headquarters a Hudson River mansion called Richmond Hill, later the home of Aaron Burr. By a curious coincidence, Burr, fresh from the failed Patriot assault on Quebec, visited Washington in June and accepted his offer to serve on his military staff, or family, as it was known. By some accounts, the aristocratic young Burr had grandiose expectations and imagined that Washington would confer with him on grand matters of strategy. When he realized that he would be relegated to more prosaic duties, he quickly quit in disgust and sent a letter to Washington protesting that less qualified men had been promoted ahead of him. He then went to work for Major General Israel Putnam. Something about Aaron Burr, his penchant for intrigue, a lack of sufficient deference, perhaps his insatiable chasing after women, grated on George Washington. Much of Burr's political future was shaped by his decidedly cool wartime relations with Washington, while other contemporaries, Hamilton being the prime example, profited from the general's approbation. During this period, Washington was at least marginally aware of Hamilton. End of Disc 3.